Welcome to the Omfer podcast.
Hello, this is Mark Sobel. I'm the U.S. Chair of OMFIF. We have a great panel today to discuss the outlook for Latin America, including with the Biden administration. Kimberly Breyer, now a senior advisor at the prestigious U.S. law firm Covington & Burling, was Assistant Secretary for Western Hemisphere Affairs at the State Department in 2018 and 2019. In her past government service, she also worked in other capacities at the State Department and the National Security Council. She has written extensively about Latin America and especially Mexico. Alexander Tombini is the chief representative for the BIS for the Americas, a good friend and former colleague of mine during his days at the IMF executive director for Brazil. He was also Brazil's central bank governor. To Argentine President Mauricio Macri and the Argentine Treasury. He is now a consultant in Buenos Aires. He's also a longtime friend of mine. Dante Mossi is executive president of the Central American Bank for Economic Integration, the Multilateral Development Bank for Central America. He had a long distinguished career at the World Bank before assuming his current position. So we're going to have two rounds of discussion on the record. And in the first, we'll have more general issues covered, second, more specific. And then we'll turn to the audience for questions. And the questions can be submitted through the Q&A function. That will be an informal discussion off the record. Kimberly, could you kick us off? Could you please offer us your thoughts on what are the key challenges on Latin America that the Biden administration will face and what he should do about them? And I hope you're going to touch on populism, the pandemic amid many others, and also given preoccupations with China and Russia, let alone at home, does Biden even have time to focus on Latin America?
Great. Well, thanks, Mark and Saul, for the invitation to the organizers. It's great to be here today. Can everyone hear me okay? Okay. You all had asked me to speak kind of about a number of things. Mark, I'll try to hit on as many of those as I can. First, I want to say, and we've got a panel of incredible economists and bankers, so I'll leave the economic analysis in their very able hands. But I will say, you know, we're at a moment where I think the challenges in Latin America are probably unprecedented. If you take, you know, kind of the normal challenges and overlay the COVID crisis and its impacts on the region, this is clearly, you know, very difficult moment. Latin America has been hard hit by COVID. We all know this. According to a recent World Bank report, Latin America was harder hit both from a health perspective and an economic perspective, more so than any other region of the world. And I think, you know, you have to sort of take that and overlay it on what we were seeing pre-COVID, which seems, you know, almost like a lifetime ago now, where we had social unrest across many countries in the region, including some of the more traditionally stable places like Chile, Colombia, and others. And I think we had a sense, you know, even pre-COVID, that the real challenge for governments in the region was delivering and, you know, delivering on promises and policies for people. And this is the stuff of populism. What makes populism so attractive, I think, is the sense that when the old ways stop working, whether it's traditional parties, politicians, or systems as a whole, you turn to other solutions. You know, and I dare say we've seen a bit of that here at home. So you add to that picture pre-COVID that you also had an unprecedented crisis unfolding in Venezuela, whose effects were and continue to be felt all across Latin America in the form of now over 5 million Venezuelans who have fled, according to the most recent data from the International Organization for Migration. You also had pre-COVID and now large numbers of people on the move from Central America due to the complex economic, social, and security challenges in key countries there, including Guatemala and Honduras, and lately, to a lesser extent, El Salvador. So this was becoming, I think it's fair to say, a difficult period for the region before we got into COVID. With all that said, and it's a fairly grim picture at the outset, I actually remain really bullish on Latin America in the sense that I think the region as a whole has a huge opportunity in front of it because of the geopolitical shifts related to China. So far, I think we're seeing quite a bit of continuity on China policy from the previous administration to the Biden one. And I think we're seeing a real continued focus in the U.S. Congress that would seem to make the trend line, which is a more competitive approach between the United States and China, likely to endure. In Latin America, we have a region committed to democracy that successfully carried out elections across the region over the past year, including last weekend, and a region that, in my view, has come a very long way over the past few decades. Latin America has got to be near the top of the list for companies who are thinking about shifting their supply chains from Asia. If you're thinking about a shift, this is not a short-term bet. It's a long-term bet for companies, and I think you've got to be thinking about Latin America among your priorities. And certainly, as I mentioned, the short-term picture is a difficult one. But I said, I am still bullish on the longer-term trend for the region. I think another, kind of key challenge that we see going forward, and we're certainly seeing it here in the U.S., is this issue of the political polarization and the ability of our governments to deliver results. These challenges are perhaps more pronounced in Latin America, where we tend to see greater income inequality. And I think, this is a foreign policy challenge as well. And my hope is that the Biden administration will settle into a foreign policy that is not ideologically driven or polarized. And if you look at, the Trump administration, the administration managed to build relationships from Mexico to Brazil and beyond across a pretty broad swath of ideological views. And so I hope that continues. In terms of the Biden administration itself, I think there are some cross currents in the thinking about how the Biden team is and will approach Latin America. And the first is exactly what Mark flagged, which is bandwidth. Will this administration be one that spends a lot of its time and energy and capital on Latin America? I think you've had some early focus with a lot of virtual meetings between White House officials and key leaders, phone calls. We have a special envoy for Central America. It is also clear, however, that this is an administration that has a very extensive and ambitious domestic agenda, and it's focused, as Mark mentioned, on China, on the reset with Europe, and on other priorities in foreign policy. So those are sort of the cross currents that I see. In my view, it is also an administration that out of the gate committed a pretty big unforced error, which I think is the immigration situation, and is spending much of its time on Latin America dealing with the crisis at the U.S. southern border, where the March numbers exceeded over 170,000 people in 1 month arriving at the border. This is far above the recent historical norms, even pre-COVID. So I also think there are indications on the upside that the Biden team sees opportunity in Latin America. I think you see it from the Development Finance Corporation. You see it from the Inter-American Development Bank. A focus on helping companies who are considering supply chain shifts, nearshoring, and increasing overall resilience in supply chains. I also think the Biden team has a real opportunity in front of it with the Summit of the Americas. During the Trump administration, the U.S. announced that it wished to hold the next summit in the United States, and it's tentatively slated to happen later in 2021. The COVID reality and the need for thousands of participants from the region, from companies, civil society, governments, and NGOs, means that the date, to me, seems likely to slip into the first quarter of 2022. The administration is certainly hoping to host the summit in person, though, of course, they will have to respond to the circumstances as the COVID situation evolves, both here in the United States as well as in Latin America. In terms of summit themes, I think this is still very much under discussion, both inside the U.S. and among the U.S. and countries in the region. But I would expect the theme to resemble the Biden team's domestic priority of Build Back Better, which could encompass a broad range of sub-themes to include health, of course, as well as all forms of infrastructure, digital inclusion, and the Biden priority on climate issues. And I do want to mention that piece, which I think is perhaps the biggest change from the Trump administration, is that the Biden team has labeled climate issues an existential threat. Climate is included in the Biden national security interim guidance as a threat to national security. And it's clear that with Special Envoy Secretary Kerry, that climate diplomacy will be the center of outreach around the world, and in particular in Latin America. The center of the Trump policy for the region as a whole was economic growth, a policy called America Crece that looked at infrastructure, foreign investment, and helping increase growth. So having the center of gravity shift to climate, I do think is a fairly significant change. That is not to say that the economic growth agenda will disappear, but I think the focus is likely to be more on the types of infrastructure and investments related to the climate agenda.
Okay.
Under the Trump administration, you saw a near doubling of the money for the U.S. Development Finance Corporation in Latin America, and a real renewed commitment on growth. And I do think much of that will continue. Wanted to just flag quickly a couple of key issues that I'm sure of interest to the group. And one is the future of the U.S. trade agenda and how the Biden team handles the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, particularly enforcement issues around labor, but also broadly enforcing the deal itself. USMCA passed in the U.S. Congress with bipartisan support, including the support of U.S. labor unions, in part because it promised to deliver new mechanisms to enforce the rules, particularly on labor. In fact, those who voted against USMCA, including our now Vice President Kamala Harris, did so citing the deal's lack of enforcement mechanisms on environmental issues. So USMCA is something to watch, and I think it's really key. The enforcement piece is really key in the upcoming debate in the U.S. over the renewal of the so-called fast-track trade negotiating authority, which expires this summer. I would expect that if a renewal goes forward, it will include some stipulations not only on labor, but also on environment. TPA expires on July 1, so that debate should be coming shortly.
Great.
I'm happy to come back to that.
30 seconds on Venezuela, and we can come back to it in the second round, too.
Okay. Yeah, finally, on Cuba and Venezuela, I was just going to say I don't think the Biden team is in a great hurry to make major changes in those policies in the early months. There's a Cuba policy review underway, and I'm sure we can expect down the line some loosening of the policy, and perhaps as soon as later this year. The Venezuela policy so far is much the same on the U.S. side with the continued recognition of interim President Juan Guaido. I think I would just add to close that we haven't seen any changes yet in the sanctions regime on Venezuela in particular. My sense is that the Biden team will be reluctant to make any changes absent real progress from the regime and a willingness by the regime, for example, to allow vaccines and international food programs into the country. So that's a quick tour. Thanks, Mark. I'll stop there.
Complicated subject. That was a fantastic and fast tour. Alexandra, could you give us an overview on what U.S. developments mean for Latin America as a whole from your perch? And thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Mark. Good to see you. And it's a privilege to be in this very qualified debate. So, sure, to understand, I think we have to take a step back and see where we were just before the pandemic. I think it's fair to say that the growth in the region was very weak in the largest countries. And the pandemic, as Kimberly was saying, resulted in a huge economic and financial shock to the hit Latin America in particularly hard ways. So I will just list three main ways that we have been affected so far. So the first one and the most important, there have been over 20 million confirmed cases in the region, over 700,000 registered deaths. This is a truly awful mark for Latin America. Social distancing rules disrupted economic activity, but the application of these rules were not particularly effective in stemming the spread of the virus. Not that they are not needed. They are, of course, needed, but it didn't result the way they were applied to contain the spread of the virus in most of the countries. Second, Exports plummeted in the early days of the pandemic. Shutdowns in exports to the United States and other markets reduced export demand and disrupted the availability of inputs. So commodity price plummeted in the very beginning of this shock. And third, a retrenchment by global investors hit Latin America particularly hard. Massive capital outflows went hand in hand with sharp depreciations, often despite significant FX interventions. The countries with the sharpest depreciation also saw large increases in domestic government bond yields, as foreign investors in particular demanded higher premium to compensate for the lower dollar value of their investments. Just a little propaganda here. Tomorrow we will publish a report on capital flows and exchange rates and monetary policy frameworks in the CCA countries in the Americas. So I invite you to go to the BIS website for reference to this report. But fortunately, Mark and colleagues, the financial sudden stop turned out to be rather short-lived. And in this regard, a swift and aggressive monetary and financial policy response from both advanced economies, in particular the United States and emerging market economies, succeeded in stabilizing markets and market conditions in a couple of months' time last year, as we remember. Fiscal policy, in turn, helped bridge income gaps, and in Latin America, governments use both contingent instruments, such as credit guarantees, and also transfer to the poor workers and also workers in the informal sector. So while necessary, as we know, the fiscal response also push up public debt levels. Large government deficits and high sovereign debt are probably the most important vulnerability in the region in the period ahead. After this introduction, let me just turn to your question on how U.S. development means for the region. I will be brief. The U.S. economy is staging a truly impressive recovery. The IMF, as you know, predicts now 6.4% growth in 2021 in the U.S., so significantly higher to pre-pandemic level, be reaching there in the United States. And there are two reasons, in my mind, why this surge in growth. First, while the U.S. did badly at containing the virus, it did very well at securing and distributing vaccines. And second, of course, the U.S. fiscal policy is, as we know, very expansionary at the moment, with a relatively conservative assumption as far as fiscal multiplier is concerned, a 0.5. The recent fiscal package will boost the U.S. growth by 2.5 percentage points this year and just above 1 percentage point into 2022. This without taking into consideration the infrastructure package, which is currently under debate in the United States. The fiscal package should also increase not only the output in the United States, but around the globe. Our models suggest that it will lift growth in Europe by around 1 percentage point, both in 2021 and 2022. For emerging market economies, including those in Latin America, our estimates point to a much smaller spillovers, and the reason is that tighter financial conditions at least partly offset the positive impact of this increase in the real channel of the economy, exports mainly. So bond yields already started to increase. Yields on 10-year U.S. Treasury have increased by 0.75 percentage point since the beginning of the year. And Latin America is already feeling a little bit of the pinch. Most countries in the region have seen the rates paid in local currency sovereign bonds increase since the beginning of the year. In Colombia, Mexico, and Peru, yields domestically have increased approximately 1 percentage point. Whereas in Brazil, we have an increase of 3 percentage points. That said, spreads on dollar-denominated bonds have remained largely stable in most cases, suggesting that this is not a sovereign risk that is at stake. Data from EPFR shows outflows from bond funds invested in the region, although there has been some respite, some stabilization in the last couple of weeks. The big question, of course, is whether the negative impact of tighter financial conditions will outweigh the positive impact of higher U.S. growth? The answer will clearly depend whether the financial tightening will remain gradual and orderly. Any rise that is accompanied by investors' exits from emerging markets, a la 2013 taper tantrum, of course, this will be a clear negative for Latin America. And the answer in terms of the impact will also depend on country characteristics. Countries with a lot of trade and limited financial linkages will tend to benefit from this very important boost in U.S. growth. So just to finalize on the positive note, I couldn't leave without a positive note. In addition to what Kimberly said of the nearshoring possibility, potential, and we have seen that it's happened to some extent, I will say that in the medium to long run, there are a number of opportunities in the region. First, digitalization is going fast in Latin America. It's proceeding quickly. There is great potential. We have seen significant digitalization in the financial system, in payments, in currencies, etc. Many people have mobile phones, not so many bank accounts, so there is further potential for increase. Second, the region is one of the best places in the world to generate a robust base of green assets to fulfill this growing mandate for ESG investments around the world. I think it's a matter of organizing this market. And as we know right now, demand's a lot larger than supply. So this is the region that could find sources of financing in the future in line with what the priorities of this administration are for the U.S. And third and last, even the increasing social inequality that we see aggravated by the pandemic shock, with the right policies in the future, this could be an engine of growth in the short to medium term, recovering consumption, investment, and sustaining economic growth in the years to come. So with the right policies, this is an opportunity. Let me stop here. Maybe we can talk later about trade policy in the U.S., the support of the administration for the new initiatives at the IMF, which I think are important for the region. So I stop here. Thank you very much, Mark. Looking forward to coming back.
Thank you for joining us today. Vladimir, could you offer us a brief tour d'horizon of the region? Who looks strong? What countries have weak fundamentals and how it all adds up? And we'll come back to some of the more with more granularity specifics later, but the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mark, and a warm hello to all the audience that accompanies our panel today. I hope we can walk away with some useful guideposts here to identify these courses of policy and politics coming from Latin America. So first, some facts on the economic front. I think the IMF just published its World Economic Outlook, and we have as many tables with projections and all sorts of key indicators that you might like and prefer in order to take a cue from the DC official perspective. As a starter, just to discuss the current course of events in LATAM, I think it's been made available there on the screen. Thank you very much. This is just sort of the big picture summary. There's a lot more meat in there in the report, but I think this is helpful as a framework to think about where we are versus the rest of the world. It doesn't mean these forecasts will be right. As my old boss in economic research for years used to remind me, forecasts, you know, are best written in pencil. As a younger economist on Wall Street, I started my career building models to spend time discussing with our clients our forecasts, but very quickly realized that I needed to gravitate towards spending time discussing with clients not the forecasts, but the risks around those forecasts, because that's where surprises come out and that's where insight is most valuable. So given everybody's views about the global economies and political cross-currents, and in particular, as Alexander mentioned, how the U.S. cycle fits into what's going on in the region, you know, we can look into a few specifics. I think what the IMF table in a summary, in a nutshell, tells us is the region is not facing external balances that lead to imminent problems. But we have a recovery which definitely will fall short of overcoming last year's shock. an uninspiring recovery of employment and reduction of unemployment trends, as well as a transitory and in some cases high inflation spike. Both of these last items obviously undermine popular sentiment. I think fiscal policy in most places has been stretched in the region, and we'll have a hard time following the script that is being proposed by the IMF of broad-based fiscal expansions and spending, and one which is being implemented in the U.S. But I think the reality is very different when you cross the border down south. So this outlook clearly gives you a lively terrain for political debates and rivalries in the region. And we have several elections in sight, and I think this is where policy decisions, will play out. Before COVID shock, we had low growth already in the region. During the pandemic, it was the worst performing region. The current bounce is positive. Commodities have been helping. China, in this respect, has been a positive driver. And the rotation in global growth with the U.S. stimulus definitely helps significantly. However, I think when thinking about Latin America, what's always in the back of our minds, and I think is a broad consensus, is the lag in terms of potential growth for the medium term and how sometimes cyclical policies, which seem well-framed, well-guided, kind of push back to the back burner a lot of reforms and progress which is needed to be done by the region. In my country, we say, well, the urgent things overshadow the important things. And I think as we think about the way Washington is designing, the script on what is the right global policy response, we need to, take the blanket out of that recommendation and really think about what's important for the region. In terms of their initial conditions to the shock. So I think on the negative side, I think that the global reflation story is tricky for Latin America. U.S. rates are up some 80 basis points, partly due to inflation expectations, but partly due to expectations of higher rates and yields, costs of financing are rising and can continue to do so. So there's very little room for the stimulus that in the U.S. has been so successful in many ways. That's, I would say, the 13,000-foot view. And let me just give you a bit of drilling down here, comparing and contrasting the two larger economies, Mexico and Brazil. I think this helps to highlight the importance of understanding diversity, not just in the global cycle, but also within Latin America. I think the best place to start with the comparison between both countries is fiscal policy. Brazil had huge fiscal thrust last year, immediately a direct injection. It was on a fiscal thrust basis, more than 5.5% of GDP. That's taking out the cyclical impact on fiscal accounts. So this was massive. Mexico, on the contrary, had the smallest fiscal response to the COVID. And so, talk about disparate policies, because for many countries, the response to COVID has involved a significant fiscal response. And we're having a clear dispersion here. This is particularly for developed countries an important initial phase to think about how they may evolve going forward. I think that in Brazil, external accounts look fine at the moment. The current account surplus, commodities are helping, but fiscal spending was up 8%, of GDP here, and breaching ceilings that put constraints and give credibility and anchor fiscal policy for investors. So I think this year we could have a complete reversal of the fiscal thrust of last year. So growth will be very hard to come by. We have had a nice bounce in growth, but I think we're seeing a cooling right now, and we don't have the policy supports at hand, I think, to provide a significant further boost. Inflation is up, so also monetary policy is shifting toward the tightening, and particularly we are having a steepening of yields. So the short-term rates are still low, but longer-term rates are high. And where does this put Brazil on investors' radar screen? Particularly financial investors' radar screen. I think Brazil, has had a very good focus on reforms at the beginning of the administration, reforms that help to improve the perceptions about competitiveness, labor reform, about fiscal accounts and sustainability of debt. However, the COVID shock led to an increase in debt to GDP from 2019 of 75% to somewhere close to 90. Even with that big increase of fiscal, the rollout of the vaccine is low. So with rates being higher, with deficits having been widened, and with debt levels high, we know these are the basic building blocks of a debt sustainability equation that investors are always looking at. So the initial reform push by Bonsolano, which gained him a lot of market confidence, with the COVID shock and the popularity decline and an uncertain environment with elections next year, Lula coming back on the ground, provides an uncertain environment. So many policy challenges there. When we look at Mexico, Mexico is Latin America, but it's not. Mexico is a very industrialized economy. So and here, the external accounts also seem well. I think when we go through the external accounts in the region, for the most part, we're not worried about the type of uncertain risks of, say, taper tantrum type environment of capital outflows that really produce a significant adjustment. So it's not the external accounts here. And in fact, in Mexico, surprisingly, last year, they did very little increase of spending. The actual fiscal thrust was hardly half a percentage point of GDP. And this year, they will not unwind anything, but it's unlikely that they have a marginal fiscal thrust again this year. So pretty neutral fiscal policy this year. A lot of benefit coming from the U.S. expansion, much more so than in other Latin countries. So Mexico is less reliant on volatility of commodities and is very benefited by the U.S. Now, what's interesting about this is that where politicians in every country are having a contest, a rush to spend more and more in order to show the population that they're really in charge of the crisis and of protecting the vulnerable. In Mexico, surprisingly, AMLO's popularity is quite high without this type of this policy response and this spending and trickle down sort of fiscal policies throughout the economy. It has not trickled. The fiscal has been tight. So we have financial investors are pretty comfortable with Mexico. The problem is more the corporate sector. The corporate sector is seeing the side of the policies of the Mexican government that is more populist, the ones where AMLO's pet projects are drawing in the fiscal funds, the role of the state in the energy sector, public electricity. And the other big item on his agenda that brings a lot of popularity to him is his discourse against corruption. With those two issues, pet projects, you can call them eventually large elephants, white elephants in many cases, he's able to carry out an alternative populist agenda that does not depend on big spending. We are looking to midterm elections here in June. And the key issue for investors is does AMLO, which currently has a close to, in one chamber has the capacity close to getting a constitutional majority, but depending on alliances, can he bring his party to actually achieve that majority on its own and thereafter really, display some political weight behind an agenda? Right. And the first item on the agenda, this I'll finish, is basically a fiscal reform targeted for September, which could change the tax landscape significantly.
Great. Dante, the floor is yours for could you briefly tell us about the challenges facing Central America? And, of course, Central American immigration to America is always a hot topic in the U.S. So any thoughts for the new U.S. administration from a Central American perspective?
Thank you very much. Let me start by saying that in Central America before 2020, it was doing actually ahead of the other large economies. I always like to remind the viewers that Central America, if we're a nation, we would be the fourth largest economy in Latin America, and we were growing above the Latin American average before 2020 hit. And during 2020, of course, we had the big recession from COVID. And then in November, we had two consecutive hurricanes that hit the Northern Triangle pretty bad. And it is totally, not on the books that we have two major hurricanes hit within 2 weeks from each other. So the region actually suffered heavy losses, not human losses as expected for a hurricane that category, but there were several losses in terms of lost output as roads, ports, and homes were damaged by the storms, particularly in Honduras and Guatemala. So coming back to the issue of migration, I recently was asked whether, migration flows are increasing because of the Biden administration or because there's something else. And my answer is quite simple. And if you ask anyone in Central America, they will tell you don't overanalyze it. I mean, there's a problem in Central America even before Donald Trump and even after Joe Biden became president. The countries have a lot of inequality, and they need to address very structural issues that they haven't dealt with properly. So these increased numbers of migrants, indeed, it might be the result of contained migration from the Trump administration era that was already in Mexico, awaiting for the doors to open. What is true, though, and look at the data in Honduras and Guatemala in particular, you can see that coffee growers are reporting that there's less labor available to cut coffee grains. So I think the price of coffee has more to do with migration than the policies from Washington, D.C. So what I want to tell you is that Central America is having, a difference of growth depending on the income you have. So very poor people is on the brink of a decision whether they leave or they stay. And probably the well-to-do individuals who have access to the capital markets and can get a second loan to address the challenges of 2020, they can actually move forward without the temptation to leave the country. So so what has changed with the administration of Mr. Biden? I think, first of all, there's a focus. There's a special envoy now, which I had the luck to chat with him this last Sunday. And indeed, I mean, migration is one major concern. And the big question that he wanted Cavey to address, and I said, gladly we do. I mean, our board has been very concerned about migration flows for the last 2 years, is what makes someone decide to leave? I mean, what is it that is in the decision-making process for a farmer, for someone who works in the fields to leave Central America? That's not a clear-cut decision. That is not that someone comes and said, oh, come to the U.S. for a better wage and leave everything behind. That's not the case. It's something more, linked to the economy. So what are we doing? And this is why I feel so hopeful about the situation. Last year, Cavey prepared this very large rescue package for post-COVID and then a second one for the resilient reconstruction of Central America, just not rebuild, build greener and better. And one of these programs has a micro-enterprise program that has been accompanied with a guarantee fund. And we had the support from all the friends of Central America. And we had the European Union, Germany, Spain, Taiwan, Korea, and even the U.S. DFC is actually providing a direct loan to Cavey, first ever in their books. And this program has been very successful in actually anchoring people to their assets here in Central America and allowing them to, innovate and decide how to face this new reality post-COVID. The vaccines are coming slow. Basically, governments have been actually going out asking companies for, you know, for access to their products. Cave provided $850 million for vaccines. And, I mean, and there are very few companies that are willing to sell to these countries, you know, on the spot. So, I mean, the only country that has been able to sell vaccines in a larger scale has been Russia from all the countries. And, you know, regretfully, the supplies from Russia will not be readily available in the short term. So it will take a month or two before they actually come to Central America. So, and these are issues that I think, you know, keep on fueling immigration. So going back to your question, what has happened? I mean, I think, the region, has postponed some investment plans that they had, but we will, work with all the governments to ensure that program keeps on going. Just to tell you in Honduras, just let me tell you one exercise that we are doing with the U.S. And other donors. One of the most productive valleys that was flooded by these hurricanes is being assessed by the Army Corps of Engineers to determine which rivers are essential to be dammed. So, if, you know, there's more of a little time before there's the next flood. And Cave is financing the studies of these dams that will actually protect these valuable lands from further flooding. So unexpected partners are actually working together in the region. I'm truly optimistic that with friends, even like the UK, that is new. I mean, we signed a treaty with the UK recently, are coming fresh to the region. And as I tell them, Central America is not asking for aid. Central America is asking for investment. And the countries are responding. They have a fantastic record of paying bills on time for the last 10 years, which is what credit risk agencies monitor. So, and we're behind that. And that's why we are rated AA, because all governments are paying on time, even the private sector, even though during these last years. So, I'm very optimistic. And, just let me say that, having chatted with, the special envoy from the, Biden administration this last weekend, it gives me hopes that this alliance will grow stronger, to ensure that economic, assistance in terms of financing will come to the region. Thank you.
Thank you for that wonderful description. Let's go. We're running a bit over time, but maybe we can do a super quick lightning round. Give you all a minute to answer questions that would take 20 minutes to answer. Kimberly, you're a Mexico expert. Vladimir has already discussed the Mexican economy, but do you just have any kind of top line thoughts on political challenges in Mexico?
Sure. And thanks, Mark. I definitely agree with all that I've heard here this morning. So the 1 minute version on Mexico is, you know, clearly, as Vladimir mentioned, there's a number of challenges across sectors in Mexico, from energy, which, you know, we all hear about in the headlines, mining, technology, agriculture, pharma, you know, regulatory and policy issues that are of concern to foreign investors. And we, you know, we track these pretty carefully in my day-to-day work. What I can say, you know, broadly is that I think we've entered sort of a new phase in the U.S.-Mexico relationship in the past few months that involves some of these economic and trade issues, but it goes further than that. It goes into the security realm. I think you're even seeing increasing divergent of views over immigration lately. So, you know, I think we're kind of in a new moment. Having said that, I had the opportunity when I was in government, you know, to work closely and forge a relationship with the López Obrador government. And between Presidents Trump and AMLO. And so I, from my perspective, you know, it can be done, even when we have different views on things. So I think the Biden team's, you know, got a challenge in front of it. You know, diplomacy is the art of the possible. And so they're going to have to find the space, where the two governments agree. And I think there is, you know, I think there are some, you know, some very clear spaces there, like social inclusion is one, but it's going to be, I think, a bit of an uphill climb. You know, I think, you know, going forward, as I mentioned at the outset, I think the key challenge is going to be now that we have a U.S. trade representative in place, and the administration and the Mexican government have announced a new high-level economic dialogue, whether, you know, via USTR and the economic dialogue, we're able to sort of make some progress and find a way to ensure that foreign investors can continue to invest in Mexico and continue to grow and create jobs and fulfill President López Obrador's promise of addressing income inequality. I think that's really the, you know, the key question right now. And it's going to be, I think, a challenging couple of years. I'll stop there. Thanks.
Thank you. Unfortunate, we don't have an hour to spend with you on that. Alexandra, well, you began to talk about the key debate in the markets now, which is what will the U.S. Growth spurt and the fiscal support cause interest rates to do? And are we looking at another taper tantrum? Some say yes, some say no, I don't, and whatnot. You talked about a little bit about that, if you can give us any greater concreteness on that. And then you mentioned at the end you had some thoughts about how U.S. trade policy impacts the region. There's also questions about global tax coming out of the meetings. Is any of that something you would like to address for us very quickly?
Very quickly, thank you again. And Mark, it's a pleasure to be with you here. Well, taper tantrum is a very difficult event to predict, right? It doesn't stand out. I mean, if you look at taper tantrum in terms of yield change in a span of 2 months, it was like one full percentage point. I mean, if you rank all the financial events in the United States, it will, the taper tantrum in 2013 will rank 20 or top 30 for in that metric. So it wasn't about a shock in yields. If you look at the emerging market, the situation in emerging markets, I mean, there were some good, bad, and ugly countries as far as economic policy are concerned in 2013. But it was not, I mean, that they were weaker than in other episodes. So what's different about the taper tantrum is that there was a major reaction and a major exit from emerging markets. I happened to be a governor at that point, and I still remember the heydays of the late summer in 2013. I had to cancel my participation, have to call STAIR to cancel my participation in the Jackson Hole conference. To stay put in Brazil to dealing with the effects of the taper tantrum that late summer. So I think we have to look into push factors more than pull, but nevertheless, it's very difficult to predict that there are some similarities, some difference today. I think some things have not changed. For instance, again, we are seeing the rising yields following a long period or intense period of extremely accommodative monetary policy, loose financial condition, increasing risk-taking. And as you know, the markets become very sensitive to news. Sometimes you see things calm down, but then all of a sudden, I think they are very sensitive to news, and you know this better than I do. And this is not different now from then. What is different is that the U.S. economy is growing very fast, fastest pace in decades now, so this should be a positive for the spillover to the countries. The other thing which is different now from then is now inflation is going up, not remarkably, but going up in the United States. Then, at the time of the taper tantrum, inflation was coming down. And I want to believe, this is a personal opinion, but that there has been a shift in the U.S. attitude towards emerging market economies. The new administration, I would say also the Fed, is much more cognizant of the importance of spillovers and spillbacks. And we discuss a lot of this at the board of the IMF. We had sometimes different visions, but I think it's fair to say that today the attitudes has changed. Apart from the obvious example of China, the other emerging markets individually are small compared to the U.S. economy. When they put them together, they do matter for the U.S. And then you internalize what's happening there, not by altruism, but by self-interest. And I think now there is a bit of this change in attitude towards emerging markets. On the emerging market side, it's a different picture. As I think Vladimir was mentioning, the external situation is better. Current accounts are more balanced or in surplus. You have accumulation of reserves. On the other hand, the fiscal is in the red. I mean, there is accumulation of that GDP at high level. As I mentioned before, is one of the most important things. So very difficult, and I don't have an answer. There are similarities and difference. Very difficult to predict an event like that. It didn't happen because of a huge shock in interest rate. It happened because we were coming from a very long period of very supportive, low for long, low forever, and so on and so forth. So we will have to see what the market reactions are to what is happening today. Just to finalize, I think because of the fiscal strain in this economy, especially emerging markets, but in this neck of the woods, in the LATAM region, I think, and given the prevalence of the dollar as the global currency, I think dollar funding continues to be an issue. I think the reaction of the Federal Reserve in 2020 was very important to support with swap lines, also with the FEMA, the repo facilities. So I think all this helped to resolve in a couple of months the dollar funding issue and give a respite to emerging markets and benefited all. So going forward, I think this is very important to continue this attitude. And I have to commend the recent decision of the U.S. government. I don't know what your opinion. I do know what your opinion was, Mark, but the support to the SDR location, it's great, should be welcome from the emerging markets. I think $650 billion is important, has a catalytic role. We know that at the end of the day, it's liquidity in dollars or other hard currencies, but I think this is a very important move. Trade, I think the trade issues have not been resolved between the two superpowers, but as some, I think Kimberly was mentioning, nearshoring could be a reality that could benefit countries in the region, some more than others, but we'll see. So I stop here.
Okay, thank you for that. Vladimir, if you have in your lightning round moment, do you have a quick comment on the rising U.S. yields? And then secondly, you're Argentinian, so I have to ask, discussions with the IMF don't seem to be moving forward. Argentina is going to run a primary deficit this year, but it has limited capital market access. So can it run a 4.5% primary deficit, as Mr. Guzman says? Is that possible? And are you worried about excess monetary financing putting pressure on the exchange rate and inflation? All in a lightning round.
So I think, you know, when you look at the region, as Alexander mentioned, you know, global rates, commodity prices, trading partner cycles, you know, these are the things we look at in terms of exogenous factors. And I think I agree with Alexander on that these are not destabilizing here. I think the most interesting discussion is really about the domestic idiosyncratic factors. Now, obviously, I mean, as Rudy Dornbusch, one favorite economist of us Latin Americans, mentioned, he said in economics, things take longer to happen when you think it will, and then they happen faster than you thought they could. So obviously there could be external shocks, but I think we're really focused in understanding, you know, what's going on country by country. And here, you know, you have the political trends we talked a little bit about in Brazil and Mexico. You have the macro that we discussed a little bit. And I think that the key issue to focus right now is the third factor, which is a new one. We hadn't traditionally focused on it. And it's really the metrics that investors, that politicians, that voters are following in terms of the COVID situation and the response. And here, unfortunately, for Latin America, it's more uncertainty at the moment rather than less, as it is more the case in the U.S. Until now, cases and deaths and now vaccinations are the type of metrics people are following. We lag Latin America in terms of vaccinations. So the very basic premise for investors or politicians to see if things are going well, which is, are you advancing on the vaccination schedule? Well, that is more of a negative here in our region. The second thing is how, you know, what this results in terms of policies, lockdowns versus reopening of economies. So the link between COVID and the economies, again, it's not fully answered for people looking at Latin America. And thereafter is how do people respond? And I think, as I mentioned, you know, we have a few elections. I already talked about Mexico and Brazil, and I think the key issues we've seen Ecuador, where Lasso a victory, I think was a positive result for the balance of politics in the region. Chile and Peru, Chile looks more uncertain with elections in November, and Peru looks quite significant in terms of uncertainty there. So I think we need to look out for that. In terms of my home country and closer to my heart, you know, I think we have no credit, and we've had a big fiscal deterioration. It's financed by monetary policy and held together with low reserves, but with capital and current account controls, which are very stringent, but are putting a significant pressure on local corporations and the business cycle at the same time. And those that anchor of the exchange rate through these heterodox controls is not really, reducing inflation expectations. And the reason is because there's not a comprehensive economic plan. The IMF did not push for one enough, and Argentina did not desire to have one at the beginning of its debt restructuring and the start of the administration last year. It preferred to do a private sector debt restructuring and then see how to handle other things. And I think things have gotten complicated with this COVID shock. There is, to your question, Mark, a stealth fiscal adjustment happening, and it's happening through inflation. But inflation is a double-edged sword in terms of politics, because at some point people feel the pain, and they want someone else to take charge. And sometimes the exchange rate, is vulnerable, and the adjustment, brings back a lot of instability. So it's a short-term, reassurance, but that breeds long-term imbalances. And I think, unfortunately, without an IMF program, we have to, you know, we're going to have a long period of uncertainty on this front. And I think, you know, the issue in Argentina also is tricky for the IMF in terms of how to get a consensus with maybe a suboptimal economic program under the IMF guidelines. Is because, you know, the old saying goes, when you owe the bank a dollar, it's your problem. But when you owe the bank $100, it might be the bank's problem. And I think the IMF as a creditor has a challenge here of how to provide room within the COVID emergency policy messaging and how to bring order and help Argentina to really stabilize and not just buy time and kick the can down the road. And that's a difficult trade-off.
Yep. It seems like a familiar story with Argentina, though on steroids this time. So, Dante, the last word, could you offer us any further thoughts you have on Central America and something that always weighed on my mind, which is the extent of crime and corruption and how much of an impediment to growth? And are major efforts on this front possible? Can your bank help? And would this help on immigration issues?
Oh, thank you. Actually, control of corruption was the big issue, the second big issue we discussed with the special envoy of Mr. Biden. And yes, actually, I would say we are pushing for two avenues to address this issue. One is transparency. So we want to support governments in developing, you know, institutions that are accountable. The main problem, I would say, for Central America, I now have worked in many countries around the world. They just get bad reputation for being very corrupt. And there is corruption indeed, but it's not as rampant as I've seen in other parts of the world. Yet, there's no accountability. There's very few presidents or ministers who go to jail because they have stolen public money. So I was discussing that one of the ways to discourage this type of behavior, this transparency, and to generate accountability from the institutions that matter, you know, the judicial system that goes against those who steal money. And there have been efforts to create these special commissions, high-level commissions sponsored by the UN or OAS, and these efforts do not support institutions. And I think if you look at countries like the UK or the US, I think they are great because of the rule of law, because their judicial system is pretty much independent and it can work on its own without interruptions from the politicians. So we discussed this, and we can help in that sense. I mean, seems, basic stuff as building courthouses and helping district attorneys to do their job better with better instruments, cameras to record, you know, activity on the street so people can go to jail if they actually do something illegal. So we have done that, and we will continue on doing that because countries have asked us to do that. And my belief is that we need to do more. But that's one thing on the support to institutions in ensuring that the public trust is kept. But the other side of the equation is that if you don't want to work with governments because of your high perception of crime or corruption, is work with the private sector. I mean, I think the huge advantage of Central America as compared with other regions is that the private sector is actually willing to bet the house on their own economic activity. So one of the activities that we are ensuring this time around is, you know, bringing the private sector to help out in financing public infrastructure in the, you know, better known in the UK, PPPs. For roads, trains, gas pipelines. And there's some experience in the region, and we are pushing for more. So I think the control of corruption is essential. I don't think it is the problem, but it is a problem that is significant to the region. And we need more transparency. And, you know, this bank, the Cave, just to give you an example, we were constructed on the principle of confidentiality. And when I came in 2018, I said no more. I mean, we need to change the basic principle that everything we do is confidential to everything we do is public. And that's a reflection of the institutions in the region. I mean, that's how they were built, and it's going to take time to change that paradigm and to make them more transparent and be truly, you know, public. So thank you, Mark.
Well, thank you. Those are wonderfully noble objectives, and I wish you the best of luck. It's been a whirlwind, a jam-packed session today, but I thank Kimberly, Alexandra, Vladimir, and Dante for joining us. It was excellent presentations. We covered a lot of terrain. Didn't have enough time, but you guys did a fantastic job. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.